Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, Cunning Cast listeners. I'm Vas Krisadoulou, host of the How To Academy podcast, a show sharing big ideas from some of the most exciting artists, leaders, and scholars around. Twice a week, we host a big thinker for an in-depth exploration of their life and work. If you want politics, we've got Bill Clinton, Madeleine Albright, Alistair Campbell, Jess Phillips, Gordon Brown, Ed Miliband, Rory Stewart, Chris Patton, and Jeremy Hunt. If it's psychology you're after, we've got you covered too, with Ruby Wax on mental health, Susan Cain on introverts, Steven Pinker on rationality, and Julia Samuel on grief. Join us and together we'll probe the mysteries of life with Richard Dawkins and of the universe with Neil deGrasse Tyson and Carlo Rovelli. We'll take a trip to Hollywood with Minnie Driver, John Cleese, Gina Davis and Jamila Jamil, and go back in time with William Dalrymple, Satnam Sangera and Yung Chang. We've got Melinda Gates, Emily Ratajkowski, Gloria Steinem and Isabella Allende on feminism, Jane Goodall and Richard Powers on the environment, and your Cunning Cast host, Sir Tony Robinson, with historian Peter Frankopan on how climate change has transformed our world. If you want to know where comic book legend Alan Moore gets his ideas from, how Nobel laureate Maria Ressa fights dictators, or why whistleblower Chelsea Manning wants to create a more transparent society, we are the podcast for you. That's the How To Academy podcast, your one-stop shop for big ideas. Available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's so exciting. Tell us what this is. What am I looking at? Something exciting, Tony?
Yeah, on my desk is, and I've just been sent this, this is 8 stamps about Blackadder that have just been released. And I'm in about 4 or 5 of them in different guises from the different periods. And can you imagine? I was that 8-year-old nerd who loved philately. And
good word. He knows the word.
Thank you. It will get you nowhere. Anyway, I would love to be able to travel back in time to and tell that 8-year-old boy, one day you're going to be on a stamp. It is the most exciting thing that's happened to me since my knighthood, I have to admit.
It's utterly thrilling, Tony. Your head on how many stamps? 6 stamps?
I think so.
Something like
yeah,
that. So we're going to make an episode about stamps.
We are.
Got to make an episode.
No, absolutely.
About stamps.
I've always wanted to make an episode about stamps.
Right, we're doing it.
It's a fascinating. And like, I mean,
coming
stamps,
soon to
yeah,
series
now,
2.
Value of stamps. History of stamps.
Is history of stamps.
Very
George V. Yeah. Huge
but
stamp
But not
collector.
Just Penny Blanks and stuff. Penny Blanks, did I just say?
Penny.
She's mattress. No, she's not really.
Who's Penny Blanks?
Yeah, it goes back different countries, different times. Yeah,
love it. We are going to make an episode for series 2 on stamps. Yep. Now, Tony, do you want to read the intro?
Oh, yes, I will. Stand by, everybody. Here comes the intro. Hello and welcome to Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. So we got to the end of season one, which I can't quite believe. It's been so fun and so fast. So I thought it'd be good to chew it all over with my producer, Melissa, and bring you my particular highlights from the series. Bring our particular highlights from the series, I think, Melissa, that should be.
Okay, I can bring, interject, absolutely, Tony. So let's take ourselves all the way back to Miriam.
Yeah.
Number one, Miriam, what a star.
She was in Tuscany, wasn't she?
She was. Yeah, we did it over Zoom, didn't we?
Yeah, and so we don't normally do that. And I was a bit uneasy because I want like to see the whites of people's eyes.
Yeah.
But because it was Miriam, because I knew her so well, it was just more like having a phone call with a mate. And to me, what is great about her is that she is so intelligent. I mean, one knows that she's smart, that she's good at delivering lines, all the rude things that she says are always so calculated to best effect. But what I wanted people to see was the depth of Miriam, and I think that's what we got. Miriam, I've known you and you've known me for, well, it's got to be half a century now. But
we met in 1966.
And where are we now? It is over half a century, isn't it? Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
And it was in Leicester and you were extremely funny in a play called Dandy Kaput. I was less funny. But we got on like a house on fire, and it's where I became a lesbian, and it's when Britain won the World Cup. I don't think the two are connected particularly, but
I think they may well be in some strange way, in some universe.
Any highlights? Anything that was revealing? I mean, okay.
Go on. I was going to say Scottish accent.
Scottish accent.
Scottish accent. Oh, you were going to say that too.
I love that. You slightly put it on the spot because you said to Miriam, you know, your voice is very posh, could be a bit off-putting. And you were really honest with her in a kind of slightly rude way, but she didn't take it rudely. Someone else might have done. Someone you've known for a long time, she didn't take it that way. But it revealed something really interesting about Miriam.
Yeah.
Was that actually, it was a vulnerability.
Yeah, she just put on a voice to obscure the fact that she was posh, whereas what me and my mum have always done all our lives is put on a posh voice to try and obscure the fact that we came from East London.
One of the things I was most fascinated by was your diction. Now, I cannot believe that was the way you spoke at school.
It absolutely was the way I spoke.
But it's so much
more... If you listen to all my classmates who are still alive, they all talk like this too. It was Oxford High School.
It's quite posh, isn't it?
Yes, I suppose it is. I wish it weren't. Because my emotional feeling is to connect with people. That's all I ever wanted to do, is to connect. And a voice like mine puts people off. You know, when I first went to Australia and I started to speak, I could see people recoil. They were shocked at the purity of my vowels. But I can't help it. When I want to connect with strangers, I usually go Scottish, because it's friendlier. But my real voice is the one I'm talking to you in now.
It's not just the way you form your vowels, though. You do use your consonants very precisely. Your tongue and your lips and your breathing are incredibly disciplined, like an athlete, really. You're like a mouth athlete in many ways.
Well, and I really trained for that, you know.
Fascinating. Someone's always someone else, but actors are always actors. You know, it's just the actor in her. She adapts. Mm. She wants to meet people. She said also she was driven and motivated by meeting people. Mm. And she loved making those documentaries because she just gets to travel and meet people.
I have had the chance to travel around the world and talk to people. And it's thrilling. I've got so much out of it, and I'm doing more, and I'm getting better at it, I think.
I think one of the interesting things about watching you is that you still are able to use quite a few of your actor's skills in front of the camera. The timing, the slapstick, the throwaway. it's not just some person going around the world. It's a professional who knows what she's doing, who's going around the world, isn't it?
Well, I like to think that I can bring some of my dramatic skills or my comedic skills to the job to make people feel more relaxed, because that's the key, is I've got to be listening and opening up other people. And I think little jokes and little self-deprecating moments helps. So that's something I am bringing with me.
Wonderful person. We love that. We all love that.
As is, he said seamlessly, Mike Parker Pearson when we made Stonehenge.
So this is Stonehenge, episode 2. Mm. There's an awful lot there. I was worried that people would just think, oh, it's a pile of old stones. Why do we want to know more about Stonehenge? But actually, the point is, people might have facts, bits and pieces of knowledge, but to put it all together like that was so brilliant. And Mike, what a guy.
We think there's probably going to be a variety of monuments in Preseli, because, of course, we mustn't forget that as well as Stonehenge, we also found Blue Stonehenge down by the River Avon, and you were there again for that discovery. So realising that Stonehenge at the beginning, at least, is at least two monuments, which are later coalesced into one. So
I hope everybody else is finding this as exciting as I do. As you said that, I'm kind of bouncing up and down in my seat. Carry on.
And I think there's going to be at least a couple of monuments in Wales that they're dismantling. Whether the one that we found called Wine Mound is part of the construction or something that happens alongside, we're not entirely sure.
But quite an energised debate about
indeed,
that, hasn't there?
Exactly. And I think the evidence now is, if they did supply any stones, it's a handful. Yeah. So we're on the hunt to see if there's somewhere else within the area of the quarries that might have actually been where these were first put up.
He was my mate, Mike Parker Pearson. I've done loads of digs with him and we really get on. And I kind of forget that A, he's a prof, and B, he is viewed worldwide as the preeminent specialist on Stonehenge. And I never really have time to press him deeply about Stonehenge because I'm too busy thinking about the documentary I'm making. Is he in shot? Am I asking him the right questions? Did he just slip up and say slightly the wrong thing? All those kind of things that you do during the course of making a show. So it was an absolute luxury for me to get him and two of my other friends off Time Team, Raksha Dave, Raksha I'm sure most of you will know, who has become a very, very fine presenter, and Alison Sheridan, who not many people will know, but is a great finds specialist. She lives in Scotland and works in Scotland. You'd think, what is she doing looking at the finds from Stonehenge? And that was one of the most interesting things, the link between Stonehenge taking us on a travel all the way up to Scotland and Scottish Isles.
They had also invented for themselves a brand new style of pottery up in Orkney. I mean, essentially what you're dealing with is very, very ambitious cowboys who were in a very fertile land, and they were able to use their surplus from their agricultural activities to build monuments and to travel long distances. So these guys up in Orkney had gone to the Boyne Valley in Ireland. They'd seen Newgrange, Nowth and Dowth, those amazing huge passage tombs. They thought, we want a bit of this here in Orkney. They therefore built Maze Howe to echo Newgrange. And we also know that they were fantastically successful, and people came from far and wide to visit and to take part in their midwinter solstice ceremonies. And we also know that they then took away the idea of using the kind of pottery that they were using up in Orkney, and we call it groovedware. And your mate, Phil Harding, he dug some groovedware at Bulford, yeah, military camp, very close to Stonehenge. You could lose that pottery in Orkney. I mean, it's just phenomenal.
The world was connected in such an interesting way, even then. Amazing. What a great episode, Tony.
Thank you.
And then we had something so totally different. It was so funny.
Well, I can remember when I first pitched this,
tell us about pies.
When I first pitched this to you, yes. The veil of failure to understand that came across your face was perfect.
Maybe it's a guy thing. Yeah. It's a man thing, pies. But I got into it.
Yeah, you did. You wonderfully. I just felt that I wanted to do some of the episodes about things that people really like. I suppose about like being a football fan. And when I was like talking to mates about the idea of doing a one on pies, and immediately they didn't say, what are you going to do? They just started talking about pies they know and love. Brilliant. Stories about pies. Brilliant. It was quite bizarre.
Well, when we dug around with our brilliant guests, Neil Buttery and David Atherton, what was incredible about that is there were so many interesting facts.
Great history on pies.
Great
do you remember
pies.
When I just flippantly raised Humble Pie and they brilliant. Told me the story, which we shouldn't give away now, but if you listen to these extracts, hopefully, Melissa, you'll edit in.
Well, I'm going to edit in now. Let's hear Humble Pie.
What about Humble Pie? Is that just a saying or was there a Humble Pie?
There was an Umbles Pie. The H has been added at some point.
What's an Umble?
The Umbles were the offal, probably the chitterlings, so the intestines. But yeah, general word for offal. And of course, it would be the humble dish. It's where we get the word humble from. So if there's a sort of a medieval banquet where everyone's invited, everyone's in the same room as the Lord, but they're not all getting the same food as the Lord, that's for sure. And by the time you're at the people who are near the back door or even outside of the door, they're getting the humble pie. Yeah. Hence the saying.
They'd be eating humble pie.
Right, so after pies, we got quite serious, Tony. But then...
In a way.
Could have been. Women, I think I said to you, let's not make this boring and serious.
And I said, if we get Jess Phillips, it ain't going to be boring and serious.
And no, it wasn't.
She is a star. Her ability to be, first and foremost, a person who cares, and to show us that the way she chooses to express that is by being a politician, is being part of representative democracy, rather than being a politician and talking like a robot, which some people, even in the party I support, often do.
That wasn't Jess. She walked in and she was honest and just herself from the moment she arrived. It was great.
Like there's now like 700 platforms to have a go at me, rather than just, you know, writing something horrible, a letter to the newspaper.
Do they always say the same things to you?
I
always get small, you, small, etc. Talentless, old.
Yeah.
A few others I won't go into now.
Yeah, yeah, it's always the same. It's always about your body. Your physical features will always feature. The worst of it, in the worst cases, it's always about sexual violence occurring to you. There's like this sort of obsession, sort of knowing that that's the worst thing to say with impunity. So it often goes to that. Often for women, much more so than men, it will invoke your children. Invoking Whoa. Your children is a very, very common thing to do. So,
this sounds like the worst question ever. But how does it make you feel?
You do get used to it. Isn't that awful? You do get used to it. It makes me feel a mixture of things. Sometimes it makes me feel desperate and sad and upset and like I don't want to carry on. And this woman I was talking to today in the tea room, she was just like, I sometimes think, is it all worth it? And I just said to her, like, will your children be any safer in the long term if you stop it? Like, if you mm-hmm. stop doing what you're doing, the answer is no. So, you know, you've got to play the long game rather than the short game. Sometimes it makes me feel defiant and like I'm winning. That's the truth. Like, you know, if you have no dissent, then you're not very interesting, maybe. I don't want these people to agree with me. I want to piss them off in a lot of cases. But, you know, there are moments. If I'm down, I mean, I'm medicated for anxiety because of the level of threat that is against me. So, and I'd say that's probably a standard procedure these days in the House of Commons. I'm not saying they're pumping it into the water or anything, although maybe they should. That's a good idea. But yeah, it's hard to deal with when you're at a low ebb with other things in your life. It can really attack you.
I texted her after we'd made this cast.
Go
I haven't
on.
Told you this, have
no.
I? And I said, Jess, we must both give up our jobs and go on a rock and roll tour called Jess Phillips in Women in Politics. And she says, great, when do we start?
I love it. This is the next thing you do, Tony. Yeah. I love it. Right, so then we moved on to, well, the big event of the year, well, one of them, one of them, coronation.
Yeah.
And it was something we sort of thought we should do. You said that Kate Williams is a friend, and Kate Williams is a wonderful broadcaster. We knew she'd have loads of great facts about the history of coronations. And we also invited Emily Nash in, who's the Hello Magazine royal expert.
Wasn't she great? Yeah, that was your idea, and it was such a good idea because you really got an insight into what it's like being a royal correspondent. And like, it sounds daft, but like only being allowed to go to the lav at certain intervals over long periods of time.
Absolutely. The marathon of covering an event like that, which is, you know, really intensive. I know it was great. They were so good together, and there was so much fantastic information about where does the Alban Sceptre come from, the crowns, all those crazy artefacts that the king got given as he sat on his coronation chair. It was great, wasn't it?
Emily, tell us about the new oil.
Well, it's just been consecrated, as Kate said, in Jerusalem, in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And again, you know, really, you can't get a more serious venue than that in terms of being the head of the Anglican Church now. But it also is symbolic because the olives have been grown on the Mount of Olives, where the king's paternal grandmother was laid to rest, Princess Alice. And so there's that symbolism as well as the religious one. And it's been brought over to the United Kingdom. Apparently the Archbishop of Canterbury, I think, commissioned this oil to be made in this way. And it's entirely vegan, which is going to please all the hipsters out there. He's really going to...
But we can't have it afterwards. We can't start putting it on our pasta even.
Absolutely not.
No, sadly not. No.
Absolutely not. But, you know, they really are thinking through the optics of everything at this point.
I think I'm right in saying that when the oil dribbles over the king's head, that that really is, your word was arcane, in that it's about somehow within the oil is the Holy Spirit, and that as the king absorbs the oil, they kind of are genuinely God's chosen person.
Yes, that is the moment. It's the most important moment of the coronation ritual. There you have that, you have the crowning, you have the monarch agreeing to their coronation oath. It's completely integral. And yet, I think that people felt that they didn't want to watch, they didn't want to be showing not only such a holy moment, but also a young woman being anointed like that in a very simple gown. I think there's probably a different sensibility about a much older man.
Smells.
Again, this was one that you had very early on, didn't you, as an idea? What did the past smell like? And it really captured my imagination because I suddenly thought, you know, what an amazing question. I've never thought of it, but it's brilliant.
I had done quite a lot of work on that. At different times in different series, that question has arisen. What did something smell like?
But the past, just putting it out there. And then, so what we did is, well, I went to William Tullett, who was a fantastic smell historian, and he put me on to Tasha Marks, who creates smells for historical exhibitions, and they were so fun together, weren't they?
They were, but the problem with that week, I was so ill. I just crawled in.
You had a cold.
I had a cold. My sinuses were so... I could hardly smell anything at all.
And your smell's not great anyway. Your sense of smell.
That was one of the
reasons
I wanted to do it. I think it seems to be a family trait. My daughter says the same thing. Don't really smell, you know.
But you did smell their smell. I mean, you could smell some of those smells. They were pretty pungent. I mean, I was at the back of the studio, and by the end of the recording session, the bug of smell was overpowering. I had no idea that smell could be so intensive, and it just hit you in that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's maybe a kind of naive thing to say, but it really was a thing, wasn't it?
Supposing after we'd all gone, someone came into the studio and they went, Melissa and Tony, Christ almighty.
The smell of hell was unleashed that day, wasn't it?
So what have you got for us next?
Well, I was thinking we could talk about miasma and how actually bad smells used to be linked in history to bad health.
Oh, yeah, I've always found that interesting, this idea of miasma. And I've never really known what it is other than, what, bad air?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good definition.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, miasma is kind of, there's a reason that it's very difficult to understand because it's a term that's very loosely applied. But broadly speaking, it's bad air and smells that often come from like rotting stuff. And that infects people with diseases like plague or cholera, for example.
Yeah, so talking of plague, I've just bought some rosemary essential oil here for you to have a little sniff. Because in those amazing beaked plague doctor's masks, they would have herbs like rosemary and sage and angelica, because what they felt covered up the smell of the plague and so kept them safe.
Yeah, I like this one. This has broken through the blockage.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
really we'll have you it. Totally unblocked by the end of this podcast.
So, thank you. Presumably then, during the time of the plague and the Black Death, rosemary would have been a big thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really popular. People would burn it. People would carry it around to smell to. I'm just having a little sniff now as well. The price of it shot up. So Thomas Dekker, the 17th century playwright, talks about how an armful of rosemary would be quite cheap, but then in times of plague, like a mere handful of it would kind of be out of the price range of kind of most everyday people.
So, Tony, John Lloyd is our highest rating episode, interestingly.
Who would have thought that? This is John Lloyd, who produced Blackadder and also lots of big series like Hitchhiker's Spitting Image.
QI,
not the 9 o'clock news, yeah.
What a guy. Legend.
But legend. A kind of legend, but you would have thought that the majority of people wouldn't know who he was. Mm. And yet, as you say, people on Cunning Cast have just loved that episode, adored it.
Yeah.
I think I get stopped in the street and asked about that episode more than any other.
It's so great people stop you in the street. That's wonderful. Well, for me, I don't know what everyone else who's listening thinks, but two men of a certain age having such a candid conversation, I started to think, God, am I meant to be here by the end of that? But
about how we felt about Blackadder.
It was so incredible that, and the honesty of which John revealed what was effectively an emotional breakdown that he had at one point, probably from work. He started to have a crisis of confidence in his life. This is a highly creative, successful individual. He was so honest about that.
What was it that you felt inside, and how did you start to mend?
Well, okay, so I was sacked, as usual, by a couple of people, some of whom you know very well. And I was very, very upset and angry because it was very unfair because, again, I'd done some things. I'd helped people out in a difficult situation and we had triumphed and won a lot of prizes and they decided I was surplus to requirements and I'd had enough of that. It happened too many times. So I kind of lost the plot and at the same time I went into my office and in those days, shows how different it was covered with awards. It was every bit of wall space and no pictures. There were just awards, dozens of them. And because in commercials you can win a lot of prizes quite fast. And I looked at these things and I thought, this is my life, 50 pieces of cardboard with writing on. That's it. That's all. That's what all I amount to. What's the point of it? What's the point of being alive? What's the point of me? So it was very difficult. And the other thing is that I suddenly realised, you know, that I didn't know anything. You know, I'd spent a lot of time, as it were, not paying attention because of the pieces of cardboard, you know, collecting those. And I didn't know what an atom was or a molecule or, you know, no idea. And it was a shock. I'd always thought of myself as not a genius or anything, but, you know, reasonably intelligent. You know, I'd got exams and things. And I thought, I don't know anything. So A, I'm useless, and B, I don't know anything. So all my validations were not available.
I love him so much, and the colours of his emotions are so varied, often quite dark, and very honest about them. And yet this is the man who's making more funny stuff than anybody else in Britain.
I love the way you had to keep telling him to cheer up. He got there in the end. There were some brilliant facts for Blackadder fans as well.
Yeah.
It was great, that one.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast with me, Tony Robinson. And today, Melissa and I are bringing you the best bits from season 1. Knights.
Well, Knights was brilliant, wasn't it? I just could smell the testosterone in the room when those guys walked in. We had two amazing historians, Toby Catwell, Matt Lewis. Toby Catwell is an armoury expert, but he also dresses up in armour and he really lives and breathes being a knight. Matt Lewis presents Gone Medieval. He's a fantastic medieval historian. Together, they were so revealing of knights. What did you feel about that episode?
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. I must admit that the majority of the stuff that they told us I already knew, but that's fair enough, isn't it? I'm not making it for myself, I'm making it for other people. How do I know? Because I'm a knight.
Darling, I'm a knight.
Yes,
I'm a knight.
And I'm on a stamp.
And I'm on a stamp. Yes, stop bragging. I know. I tell you what I remember about that episode, recording it, is when you asked Toby to tell you about the process by which it took to get knighted in the medieval times. It was a very long, detailed conversation. It was great, really interesting. And it was like, oh my God, how long did it take? And then he turned around and said, so Tony, how was it for you? And you told him, well, I got a letter from the palace, go along, walked in the wrong direction.
Went home.
Went home. Yeah. Let's hear it.
Yeah.
On the night in question, I got loads of mates in and we turned on the telly at 10 o'clock and there was a picture of me in the daytime. And the first item on the news, on one half of the screen, there was me as Baldric walking in ermine when for some reason or other in that particular plot I'd been ennobled. And on the other side, there was me going up the steps in a very, very sharp Italian suit, I have to say. Just me, my wife and my two kids. And basically, I just walked into that big ballroom in Buckingham Palace, knelt down. Oh, no, I forgot to kneel. I was just staring at Prince William. It was the first one he'd done. He was staring back at me. And I'd forgotten what I was supposed to do next. And then I saw him sort of batting his eyes slightly, and I realised he was subtly signalling for me to go down on my knees.
I know what the next word you're going to say is, and it has four letters in it.
Dogs.
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 We just love dogs. I also love dogs. I have a dog. You have a dog. It was a no-brainer. We're going to make a programme about dogs.
This was actually the very first programme we made. Do you remember? We made it before the movie. It was, in a way, it was like our pilot, the lost pilot.
Yeah, and it was so fun to make. And it made us think we wanted to make a whole series about, you know, your histories. And we talked to two dog professors, Clive Wynne and Ingrid Teig. They were both brilliant. So much takeout from that. Loads of stuff I didn't know about dogs. Yeah. I have a dog. I keep looking at my cute little now I'm thinking, you're related to a wolf, and it makes me laugh every time.
It's been a fascinating discussion, but there is one huge question that I want to ask you both before we finish. Do dogs really love us? Because you could argue, couldn't you, that actually they're onto a pretty good thing, and as long as they learn to look at us with their little winsome faces and to put their paw up when they're not getting sufficient attention and to bark cutely when they haven't been fed for a few hours, well, it's going to kind of look like love, but it's going to deliver pretty well for them.
So we have all sorts of scientific evidence now that our dogs really love us. We see it in studies that are done where dogs have been trained to lie perfectly still in MRI brain scanners, and we see patterns of activity in their brains when they're reminded that their beloved human is nearby that show how rewarding they find the presence of their human. We find it in studies of the hormones in dogs' bodies, and there's a hormone called oxytocin, which spikes in the bodies of two individuals who are deeply in love with each other and look lovingly into each other's eyes. And studies out of Japan show that this happens in dogs with their people, just as it happens with people who are in love with each other.
I probably haven't told you, but Jack D got in touch because he and Sean Walsh have got they've got a new podcast about dogs, and they heard my episode. And so they said, if we plug Cunning Cast, would you come on and be on our dog podcast? So I did.
And you talk about Holly Berry?
Oh, we talked about my dog Holly Berry non-stop.
Good.
Because it's a long and in many ways quite a poignant story about my Holly Berry. But the funniest thing was that we all have voices that we talk to our dogs in. Jack actually has a voice which is the voice of his dog talking back at him.
I just can't wait to hear Jack's voice. I mean, Jack does brilliant voices, doesn't he?
The voice of his dog is the voice of Mickey Flanagan. He doesn't have a dog. Mickey Flanagan must quite clearly dress up in a dog suit and pad round after him the whole day. It's quite bizarre. But it was very funny, and they're both terribly good at doing podcasts, so I would recommend their podcast, Oh My Dog, with Jack D and Sean Walsh. And it's really, really worth a listen.
I cannot wait to hear that. I absolutely am a huge fan of both of those guys, and I'm a huge fan of dogs. Tony, we find ourselves coming to the end of our, when I look down our list, that Census was number 10, and what a great number 10 it was. We had so much fun doing Census. It was kind of like, we started like, this is for data nerds, but actually the amount of information was so fantastic, so interesting.
I think we both went through the valley of the shadow of doubt about this one, because there's something about the word census which just kind of isn't sexy.
It surely isn't. The word sexy and census don't tend to go
not,
together.
Not very often. And yet we both knew that the national census, certainly as far as people have any interest in history is concerned, it's like the doomsday book of current history, isn't it? It gives you so much valuable information that you just couldn't get any other way. It's a snapshot of a particular time. And I thought the Jessamy and John, who we got in to talk about it, were really great at painting that snapshot.
They were both brilliant. Jessamy works the National Archives, so she does the history, and she'd done the 1921 census.
Jessamy Carlson.
And John Rawls Smith, who is part of the Office of National Statistics, so he was talking about the current census. Mm. And I love the way that they work together. I don't know if they knew each other particularly, but you know, we're talking about the census 100 years apart, and they really kind of got it, and they were able to make those comparisons across time. That was great. Any top facts from it?
Oh, there's one that just leaps out at me. I have been interested, as I think all the best historians are interested now, in all the voices that we don't hear in history. To be quite candid, I don't think that there is all that much value in an awful lot of what we call history, because you never hear what the women were thinking or the black people were thinking. Or, you know, you could draw a list of about 20 people who are kind of expunged from most history. And they are there in the national census, but often really quite sneakily. So there would have been a lot of lesbians who were living together in the, say, the early 1920s, who weren't able just to stand up and come out, as it were. But they do in the national census, because if they're just living together on their own, they both call themselves head of household. You don't have in the rest of the national census two heads of household. And they'll talk about shared occupancy. They're actually waving a big lesbian flag. It's just, it's done very, very subtly. And to know that, to understand that, I felt an awful lot of love for these women who are championing their relationships, albeit in quite a sly way.
Good for them. They were finding a voice, weren't they? Finding their voice and waving at us from history. That was so moving. Let's have a listen to that clip.
In 1921, homosexuality is illegal, which makes it a very different space to be publicly declaring yourself. However, we do still see people essentially telling us that, you know, they are living in those relationships. We see quite a lot of joint head of household or co-head of household appearing amongst people that we know to have been in same-sex relationships, and then running a keyword search on that, going, okay, so we know these people who we know to be gay or lesbian or trans, identifying themselves in this way. Okay, so are there other people? Yeah. And my colleague Vicky has blogged about this brilliantly, and you can look at that in the National Archives blog, and she talks about this at length. But we start to see other groups of people positioning themselves, identifying in that same way, and particularly around that co-head of household, that idea that they're actually, it's not so much as expressing their sexuality, but they're expressing their equality
their
in the household.
Within a relationship.
I think that's really interesting.
Isn't that interesting? Because so often we're governed by where we are now, and we think that the ideas that we have and the attitudes that we have are just contemporary. But the idea that in 1921, two women would say, we are both in charge of this household, is just kind of moving, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Tony, we've come to the end of series one.
Yeah.
I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
Enormously, enormously. Not as much as I'm going to enjoy series two.
Can't wait to make more. We will do stamps. What else are we
going to
do?
We have a list of about 40 things that we're going to...
We do.
I think, given how popular Stonehenge was, I think I want to do Hadrian's Wall.
Someone suggested that. In fact, I was going to say to our listeners, if anybody's got any ideas about what they want for Series 2, send them to us. Please tweet to us. We can find us at Instagram as well, at CunningCastPod. Give us ideas. Hadrian's Wall was a listener who loved Stonehenge. So how about Hadrian's Wall? And we were like, yes, absolutely. That works really well.
Everyone who is listening to us now could, I know, draw up 10 titles for CunningCast in about 20 seconds.
There we go. There's a challenge to our listeners. So, Tony, thank you. It's been great. I'll see you. Can't say it.
Do you know this is about the third take and she still hasn't got it right.
Well, I'd love to present to Tony. No, excuse me.
This is our relationship, so this mean. Bickering. Go on.
So mean.
1, 2, 3, go, Melissa.
I'll see you at Series 2. You're so mean to me.
Thanks for listening. If you want to join in the conversation or suggest a theme for my next series, you can find me on Twitter at Tony_Robinson. And you can follow all our podcast news on Twitter and Instagram at CunningCastPod. Don't forget to follow us and please subscribe to make sure you don't miss a single episode. I'm Tony Robinson, my producer is Melissa Fitzgerald, and this has been My Cunning Cast, a Zinc Media production. Stay tuned.
If you do not wish to accept this call, please hang up now.
Today, there are 2,916 people trapped in British prisons on the IPP sentence, many for minor crimes.
Once again, the system is just leaving me to rot.
None of them know when they're getting out, or whether their IPP sentence could actually mean life in prison.
There's no doubt that there are people in prison on IPP sentences who, if they were sentenced today, they would be on a determinate sentence, serve a year, 2 years, and they would be out of prison. And that's a scandal.
I'm Sam Asimadu. Over the course of this podcast series, I'm digging deep into the plight of IPP prisoners and their families.
I feel like I have a skeleton of a brother left.
To find out what has gone wrong with this sentence.
This sentence has finished him already. He's done his sentence now at least 8 times over.
And shine a light into the dark corners of the IPP prison story.
It's a bit of a Kafkaesque maze, really, which a lot of these IPPs seem to be on.
Trapped, the IPP prisoner scandal. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.